Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Trail Culture. I'm your host, Em Robertson, and I'm so stoked that you're tuning in. It is 2025, the year started with a bang, and I am more than ready to be back releasing episodes after a great break. I hope you all took some good time off this holiday and that the year has just started off so well. As usual, Trail Culture wouldn't be happening without the help and continued support of Carbon Endurance, a product distribution house that has all your training and racing needs covered. For those who are taking on big training blocks in this heat, Carbon Endurance offers guidance on heat training and has amazing options for recovery in their Pillar Performance product range. All of this is rooted in science, it's the real deal, and their team knows their stuff. All of the info is in the show notes for you guys to check out more. I hope you all enjoy the episode, and I'll be back here next week with the next one. Hey everyone, welcome back to another Trail Science episode, our first of 2025. Both Simon and I are very happy to be here. I almost want to say back by popular demand. I'm actually going to go for it. I know that there's a couple of avid scientific minds and listeners out there who have been where the Trail Science episode's at. So yes, for those who are new to this, Simon Duvall is a coach at Rooted in Dirt. He is a scientist. He's a runner. Despite what his Strava profile might say right now, he is, and he trains super scientifically. And Simon was a guest on the OG Trail Culture podcast, and we just saw this gap and this need for having kind of episodes that are committed to some more scientific discussion. So how it all came about is after much creative back and forth, Trail Science, that's the name we landed on. We opened it up for the people to change it. You guys, nobody vetoed us, so here it is. And these are the episodes that we release once a month. We've covered a ton of stuff from pacing to fueling to power, the use of power as a metric in trail running, which I think was one of our most popular episodes. Any case, and now, yeah, so today that's a little recap of why we do this and kind of who Simon is. And we've discussed his PhD as well, which will be the topic of today's episode, the updates, where you at, how is the trail running world changing one VO2 max test at a time. And we also are just excited for this year and kind of what that holds. But Simon, what's up? How's it going?
Well, I mean, it's not one VO2 max test at a time. Anyone who's been participating in my research over the last 18 months or so will tell you it's been about 75 VO2 maxes at a time, I think. So there's been a lot of testing. I do want to address two things that you raised there. Number one, when you put two creative minds like yourself and myself together, you can't expect much of a better name than Trail Science, and we're sticking with that. So
I love it.
If you wanted something else, it's too late. Number two, you took a pot shot at my Strava, and I don't appreciate that. I've looked at your Strava. Actually, I have it here on the record. So if
the Patagonia mountain range.
Yeah. I mean, this looks like, except, some of this mountain range is at sea level because there's nothing being done. Emily she's doing some things on Strava. And we will discuss the 10% rule at some point, but it's not something that either of us practice religiously, clearly. It's lovely to be back. I've missed these conversations with you, and hopefully we can continue to talk about some cool science in the space, and always encourage your listeners to reach out to you and suggest different topics and things that they might want to hear more about or learn more about. We're very open to that. But other than that, I'm good. Yeah, I'm really hoping that this year is the year of PhD completion.
Nice.
My examiners have been nominated, and my supervisors are aware of my intent to submit, and there's still quite a lot of writing that needs to happen, but it all seems feasible at this point, and I can see the light at the end of the tunnel after many years of just head down and just trying to make slow and steady progress.
That's great, Simon. I am excited to intro you soon as Dr. Simon Duvall. Huge.
Yeah, that'll be, I mean, that's when I'm going to leave Trail Science. I'm going to go on to, yes. I don't know, you know, bigger and better things.
I have conversations with all the other doctors. Yeah. Just one conference to the next. I love it.
No, I'll always be a Trail Science fan and supporter. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that day very much.
I can imagine. And Simon, yeah, I think there's so many things that I want to get into. It's like, what are topics that we are excited about? What kind of, how do we see this year playing out with the Trail Science episodes? But I think let's start. I really want to chat about your PhD. I mean, this is selfish in some ways because I haven't had an update in a couple of weeks. So I'm like, oh yeah, where are you at? But can you, for those who maybe haven't listened to the previous episodes, can you kind of give us a broad overview of your project, maybe some of the twists and turns it's taken, and then just like kind of what phase you find yourself in currently and any developments from our previous episode. But
I'll keep it brief just because, you know, your listeners can go back to some of the previous episodes to find out more, and I don't want to bore those that are regulars, but the broad topic is physiological indicators of ultra trail running performance. Started off by doing kind of a systematic review of what we already know in the space, and identified some gaps that we might need to fill in terms of understanding what makes a good trail runner or ultra trail runner. I've since done kind of a pacing analysis and looked at UTCT 100K performance and how athletes should go about pacing their endurance efforts. And that's actually just been officially published. It was accepted for publication towards the end of last year, but it's been published now in early Feb. So that's great news. You can maybe put that in the show notes. Unfortunately, it is behind a paywall, as these things are. But if you listen to our podcast on pacing, you'll get a lot of nuggets of information from that anyway. And then about 18 months ago, maybe less. Yeah, no, about 18 months ago, I was in South Africa. We recorded it in person. Presentation, podcast. That was actually the first, I think, episode we did in.
Wild.
Where I talked about my PhD, and that data was about developing a new trail running test where we look at kind of mild, moderate, and steep incline running. And we want to look at not only maximal aerobic capacity or maximal oxygen uptake, which is kind of that ceiling or that, you know, reserve, let's say, that runners have to draw from in terms of energy production during endurance efforts. But we also wanted to look at efficiency. So obviously when you're running 100 Ks, 50 Ks, marathon, you're not running kind of at that ceiling. You're not running at VO2 max. You're running at some fractional percentage of VO2 max. And we know that we can improve that. We can improve running efficiency through training, whereas VO2 max is quite difficult to improve. Mm-hmm. You can improve it, but it kind of stagnates after a while. And it's impacted mostly by genetic and structural issues to do with the heart and circulating blood through the body. And so we developed a new test looking at much steeper gradients than most researchers are looking at. And I've just finished writing that paper. It's going to be submitted to the European Journal of Applied Physiology in the next few weeks. And that was looking at the reliability, the test-retest reliability of this new test. Obviously, when you develop something new, you want to make sure that every time someone uses that around the world, that you're getting consistent measures and recordings. Typical daily kind of intra-individual means the same person, you know, within themselves, daily variation in these physiological measures is anywhere between 2 and 5%, I would say, on average. And our test was within that range. So we were quite, you know, happy with what we found. And then that led to me coming back to South Africa about 3 months ago now. So a year after that initial visit, and testing 19 ultra trail runners who finished UTCT 100K in November of 2024. So invited them back 2 to 3 weeks after the race, put them through their paces, VO2 max test, submaximal trail test. And now I'm kind of playing with that data, which will go into my fourth and final article, or final chapter, if you will, of my PhD. And yeah, we find, you know, we're finding some interesting stuff. It's still early days, I would say. But it does seem to me that uphill running, particularly in the steep gradients, has probably the strongest correlation to overall performance, rather than like your moderate and mild uphill running. And that efficiency is generally a stronger performance marker than maximal aerobic capacity, that ceiling. So yeah, we're seeing some things that we kind of thought we might see. I'm yet to understand some of the nuanced data where we had, you know, during the submaximal test, we did some hiking and running. So I'm quite keen to kind of explore that in a little bit more depth, because obviously anyone who runs really far knows that you're not always running, particularly up the steep sections. So there's still some nuanced stuff to look at. I'm still in the kind of early phase, but it's looking sort of how I expected it would, I guess, which is actually not that common. I think, I mean, you know this from study.
Yes.
Like the pressure when you're like a undergraduate or postgraduate student, you're like, I've got this hypothesis and it must be correct. You know, this must be the case. If it isn't, the whole study's a disaster and it's a waste of time. And
yeah,
I mean, that's clearly not the case. But in this case, it looks like we kind of, it's where we expected it to be. Definitely doesn't explain the full performance puzzle. There's a lot of other things that go into it, but it's looking positive.
That's so cool, Simon. I mean, I can't believe it was 3 months ago already. Time flies that you were back.
Yeah, I missed you. I think you flew out as I flew in or something. Planes kind of touched sides as we were.
Yeah, I saw you there was one, my annual Steady Shakeout appearance. I really need to change that.
Yes.
And Gino's Pizza. But yeah,
I think how can I forget?
Lots of PhD chats, lots of, we even had Dan appear.
He was the most tanned human being I've ever seen in my life.
I know.
I live in the UK now, and it's like you don't see people looking as tanned as Dan did. And he only arrived from the UK himself like 2 weeks prior. How do you get that much tan in 2 weeks?
I think he just lived on Table Mountain. That was it. He was just like, this is my home now. But Simon, the post UTCT, like 19 runners through the lab, I think that's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, they've just run.
Yeah, and thank you. If any of those guys are listening, thank you so much for coming to the lab. We had some technical difficulties with the instrumentation. We had two guys come in, you know, all the way from Cape Town during their work day, arrive at the lab, equipment's malfunctioning, getting technicians to come in, take the equipment away, fix it, bring it back on a weekend. Guys are coming back on weekends. We had guys traveling to us from,
I know, shout out
like the George Otaniqua area. It was amazing. Yeah,
I almost shared a name, which is probably not allowed, but like,
yeah,
those of you who know, I've never met somebody who would drive from George to,
yeah,
in the sake of science.
I'm forever indebted to these people. I've actually started writing the acknowledgements to my PhD. The organizers of Ultra Trail Cape Town, who've been very supportive of my research over the years, but then also the participants, both in the previous study. I mean, the guys in the previous article had to come in 3 weeks in a row for two VO2 max tests and three submaximal tests. I mean, it was a lot of time.
Wow.
And there were 24 of them. And then we managed to get 19 for for this round. And it was tough. Like, I mean, 2 to 3 weeks after an ultra trail race, there was a lot of guys who dropped out, guys who didn't finish. One guy had like a knee niggle, and I was like, please come into the lab, please, please, please. And he was like, I'm really not sure if I can. And I was like, just this one last, like, you know,
like one last
sort
hurdle
out afterwards. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm forever indebted to people like that. And I think, it's maybe a you know, peeking behind the curtain, so to speak, for some of your listeners, like these research settings, you get these papers and these, you know, they're published in peer-reviewed journals and stuff. But like when you work with human beings, the research environment is never perfect. We try and control as much as we can. We try and exclude data that might be, you know, outside of a normal distribution, or might be something wrong with it. And you try your best, but it's not perfect. It's never perfect. In an ideal world, I would have wanted to test these guys like right before the race. So that I've got the tightest window in terms of understanding the underlying physiological metrics, you know, as close as possible to the race. But that was during my teaching semester in the UK. I couldn't get away. I then kind of toyed with, okay, well, if we can do it afterwards, how long do you need to wait before somebody's kind of ready to do something like this again after a 100K race? You go to the literature and you see what other people have done, and you can't wait too long, because if you wait too long, then you've got kind of a either kind of a detraining effect that occurs after the race, or some people have started to train again, others haven't. You know, some people, it's December in Cape Town. So one guy was an international guy who listened to I did a webinar for UTCT on pacing prior to the race. And he messaged me and he said, oh, this is great. I really want to take part in your study. Because afterwards I was like, please come and participate in my testing. And it was like, oh, I'm really interested, you know, I can come in, but I'm gonna spend the next 2 weeks on like wine farms in Franschhoek and Stellenbosch, and I'm not sure if I'll be like adequately prepared.
Funny.
All of these things, you know, contribute to the challenge of doing research on human beings. So there are limitations to any study, and that's important to realize as well. When I get examined, that's what my examiners will grill me on, you know, why did you do this? What does this mean in terms of the interpretation of your data and that kind of thing?
Yeah. I think you've done a great job, Simon. I'm super excited about the results, and I think people don't realize, like, when you say you've just finished writing this article and like it's gone off and it will hopefully be accepted and published. And like, those are such big milestones. And I think we breeze past those sort of things really fast, or like people will just expect, and I'm sure later, like in your tenure, people will be like, oh, Simon was just publishing, but it's a big deal. And I'm excited that you're adding to like the body of trail running research. I mean, that's something that we're both interested in, and it's just great that there's like high quality research coming out of South Africa as well. So there's like multiple wins in the situation. Simon, based on that time that you spent in the lab with the 100, I know you said you haven't got into all like the nitty gritty parts of kind of the results, but with your like the hypothesis you had, what you were seeing, were there any like surprises during testing, like confirmations? What was your main like takeaway from that route of testing?
I think the thing that's interested me the most was kind of between I'm calling them study 3 and study 4, because they were quite like clear. I came in 2023 to do my data collection for study 3, which was the reliability, and I came in 2024 to do my data collection for article 4. I'm doing 4 articles for my PhD, and so I call that study 4. I've been wrestling a lot because we're in the kind of the end phase for study 3 and submitting that to European Journal of Applied Physiology, and what struck me most is just how much more oxygen consumption takes place for every kilometer traveled when you move at steep uphill gradients. So I was doing a, just for reference, I used this equation that was developed by a guy named Alberto Manetti in 2002. And he put, I think it was 10 or 12 elite trail or mountain runners at that stage already in the early 2000s. Through a series of treadmill running tests where they went all the way from positive 40% gradient, so like super steep uphill, to negative 40% gradient. So they flipped the treadmill belt around, and then instead of running kind of up the treadmill, they were running down the treadmill, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And what he was doing with these 10 guys is he was literally going kilometer by or should I say not kilometer by kilometer, that he was going percent by percent in gradient. So he started at 0%. And then he said, I want to measure what the oxygen cost is for, you know, person X when they're running at, let's say, for argument's sake, 10 kilometers an hour at a 0% gradient. And he might have worked that out, you know, I don't know. Let's call it 2,000 milliliters of oxygen per minute or whatever. And then what he tried to do was he said, right, well, I'm going to increase the treadmill to 1%. And I'm going to see how that impacts your oxygen uptake. So 1% is obviously a little bit harder than 0%. And so we imagine you might need to take in or utilize more oxygen to fuel that kind of intensity. Mm. But what he did was he said, right, well, I'm not going to have to develop an equation, because what he wanted to actually do was to keep the oxygen cost the same. Okay, so run at 0% and then run at 1%. Now, your oxygen cost goes up to 2,050 milliliters per minute. Okay, now I'm going to reduce the treadmill speed from 10 kilometers an hour to 9.9 kilometers an hour to bring it back down to 2000. And he literally did that with these 10 guys through every single gradient, 1%, 2%, 3%, all the way up to 40 and all the way down to negative 40. And obviously, as you can expect, as soon as the treadmill gradient increases, the oxygen cost increases. And so you had to slow the treadmill down. Interestingly, with downhill running, the oxygen cost actually drops initially. So when you start running downhill, because gravity is supporting you, let's say, in moving downhill, the oxygen cost is lower. But when you get to a certain gradient, it starts to increase again. And I can't remember what that gradient is, so don't quote me on it. Maybe, let's for argument's sake, say minus 10% or minus 15%. Yeah. But then actually the oxygen cost starts to come back up. And it's because of the high braking forces that are required to kind of slow you down when you run at a fixed speed. And so I used that equation to develop the speeds for my submaximal test. Now, I only looked at uphill running. So 5, 10, so 0%, 5%, 10%, and 25%. But that equation allows you to basically plug in. So you plug in, you say, right, well, I want to mimic 10 kilometers an hour and 12 kilometers an hour. So 6 minutes a K and 5 minutes a K at a level gradient. I want to mimic that at 5%, 10%, and 25%. What treadmill speed should I run at?
Yep.
So 5% gradient to mimic 10 kilometers an hour. And we were running at 7.7 kilometers an hour. And then a 10% gradient to mimic 10 kilometers an hour, we were running at 6 kilometers an hour. And to mimic 12 kilometers an hour, we were running at 7.2 kilometers an hour. And then at a 25% gradient, we were, and I say here, inverted commas, running at 3.4 kilometers an hour and 4 kilometers an hour for a 12 kilometer per hour equivalent. Now, 3.4 and 4 kilometers an hour are hikeable, so you can hike in those gradients. But what we found was
participants to run.
So, like, what
try not to hike.
Well, what I learned from my mistakes in study three, so we actually found that the reliability in the final two stages of the test was a bit lower than what it was in the first three stages at 0, 5, and 10%. And one of the reasons I suggested was when I did the first study, I actually allowed them to shuffle in between gates. So I kind of said to them, run to comfort. You know, if you feel that you would normally be hiking this, you can hike it. If you feel that you would normally run this 25% gradient, you can run it.
Yeah.
And what inevitably ended up happening was the fitter guys, the elite guys, they would run because they would normally at those slow speeds run up those gradients. And the guys towards the back of the pack, they would walk. They were like, why would I run this? Like, I'm going to walk this. And the problem with submaximal exercise is that when we do reliability testing, we try and reach a steady state of oxygen demand. So when you change velocities, there's kind of a delay in oxygen uptake. So there's this kind of instantaneous demand on the musculature to meet the demand of the new speed.
Yeah.
But there's not the time that it takes to oxidize the fats or the glycogen or whatever to provide that through aerobic metabolism. And so there's a delay in oxygen uptake that comes from kind of anaerobic sources. And to kind of wash that out and get to almost a steady state, it takes, depending on who you read, anywhere between 2 and 4 minutes, let's say. And because each stage of my test was only 4 minutes long, if somebody was shuffling between different gates, you know, like they started off running and they thought, oh, I can run this for 4 minutes. And then they realized, hang on, actually 25% at 4 kilometers an hour is quite crazy. Difficult. So I'm going to settle back into a walk. What we found in that study three is when you're walking, the oxygen cost is dramatically lower. So actually, those elite guys who were running, their running economy, inverted commas, was worse than the sub-elite guys, you know, the guys at the back of the pack, because the guys at the back of the pack were walking. And so certainly, I think one of the interesting things was if you can walk, and there's no requirement for you to run unless you're really proud and you're like, I don't walk hills, I don't whatever, then walk, you know, certainly it reduces the oxygen cost. If you're trying to make a move on someone, or obviously in a trail race, you're not running at a consistent pace. So there's variability in how fast you're moving. So it's a little bit different, but you know, sometimes you got to run. You feel you got to run, then you got to run. But I would say if you're trying to beat the runner next to you, if that's your only focus for the race and they are running and you are walking or hiking and you're going at the same speed, then you should absolutely hike, because later in the race, you'll pay dividends for taking it easy there. So that was one thing that was quite interesting, was that, you know, the guys who were walking were more efficient, metabolically at least.
This is like every 100K runner's dream. They're like, I'm more efficient at walking. That's great.
Yeah, exactly. But what was also interesting was, so if you look at the five stages of the test, excluding level running, if you look at 5%, then two gradients at, or two speeds at 10% and two speeds at 25%. Stage one, so 5%, then stage two, the first 10% gradient, and stage four, the first 25% gradient. They were all created at, using Minetti's equation, using a 10 kilometer per hour equivalent at level running. And then stages two, stages three, which is the second stage of 10 kilometers an hour of 10% gradient, and stage five, which is the second stage of 25% gradient, they were 12 kilometer per hour equivalents. And what I found was really interesting was that the oxygen cost was significantly greater, not only comparing the 12 to the 10 kilometer per hour equivalents, But going the steeper you went uphill, the greater the oxygen demand was. And so your running economy was kind of quote unquote worse. You were less efficient. And that's just purely because you've got to move your mass, you know, your center of mass up a very steep hill. And what happens when you have to move a heavy weight up a hill is that you recruit larger motor units, larger muscle fibers and muscle groups, and they have oxygen demand. And so they say, send me oxygenated blood. And so your body, you know, in kind responds by doing that. But what was interesting was the heart rate itself didn't change. So the heart rate at 10% and 25% was very similar. You know, so again, the heart rate at 5%, 10% and 25% gradient for the slower speeds, the 10 kilometer hour equivalents, were all very similar, like within 1 or 2 beats a minute. And the heart rate at the second stage of 10% and the second stage of 25% was very similar. But what do we have as runners, as metrics when we're out in the field? We have heart rate. And so we often, you know, your coach will say, right, you've got to stay in this heart rate band or whatever the case is. And you could do that. You could be in the same heart rate band.
Yeah.
But depending on how steep it is, the oxygen demand might be a lot greater when you're in those steep gradients. Now, I think what that means is we need to be careful when we're in the kind of really steep uphill gradients, that we don't overextend ourselves. But what's quite interesting from like a physiological metabolism perspective is normally if you do like a VO2 max test, right, you want to measure your maximal oxygen uptake. The limiting factor, I mentioned this earlier, is mainly kind of structural and genetic factors. So it's got to do with your cardiac output, which is the stroke volume, how much oxygenated blood you can pump to the working muscles. And, you know, we all have, you know, bigger frames will have more blood, we'll be able to pump more blood. But they've also got, you know, larger surface area of the lungs, so they can take in more oxygen through the lungs and they can distribute that. They also have larger ventricles of the heart. So cardiac output is stroke volume times by heart rate or heart, you know, beats per minute. And there's everyone has an upper limit in terms of sinoatrial node depolarization, which is responsible for the electrical activity of the heart. So we all have a limit, right? We can't, like once you reach your max heart rate, it's not going higher than that.
Yeah.
There's an electrical problem essentially. And it's not going to go any higher.
Crafty would be so proud, Simon, of all this physiological talk.
I'm telling you, Emily, now that I'm deep in the PhD, I'm like relearning all my. I'm just like, please tell me I don't have to relearn the Krebs cycle too. but anyway, so for your maximal aerobic capacity, it's these central and genetic limiters that are responsible for the ceiling. It's the heart electrical activity, and then it's the like ventricular strength that they can contract at, and the size, you know, how much blood you can pump out of the heart. But when you get into your submaximal intensities, it's got a lot to do not only with these kind of central things, but like training related adaptations. Okay. So when you do endurance training, your, level of capillarization, so your capillary density, which is responsible really within the working muscles for getting the oxygen out of the cardiopulmonary circuit, like your veins and your arteries, and into the muscles. Mm-hmm. So that increases in density, so that can happen at a faster rate or, you know, more efficient rate. But we also see changes to muscle fiber type. So, you know, type 2 muscle fibers, which are classically kind of anaerobic, becoming more aerobic or having more aerobic power, more mitochondrial density, which is the powerhouse of the cell responsible for aerobic metabolism. And so I think, you know, I'm aware that you can train your max, you can train your ceiling, but everyone will have a limit in terms of their ceiling. But what we're really trying to do is we're trying to be more efficient within what we have. And I think what's interesting about the really steep kind of uphill running or uphill walking, is where is that increase in oxygen uptake coming from? You know, it should be, according to Minetti's equation, it should be the same cost at 10%, 5%, 0%, and 25%. But why is it much greater for the guys that I tested at 25%? And it can't be because of central things, because we would expect to see the heart rate increase, right? Yeah. Like we didn't see the heart rate increase. So it must be, and this is where I'm, you know, speculating, and I'm still trying to explore this a little bit, but I'm assuming it's got to do with kind of arteriovenous difference. So something within the muscles itself, it's like, okay, there's more oxygen diffusion into the muscles that, you know, that are, because there's larger motor units that are kind of being recruited and demanding oxygen. So that was really interesting to me to see, like, oh, well, we're actually kind of inefficient, quote unquote, going uphill. That might make sense. But because of the constraints that I had, I thought that it would be the same. I thought that 25% would be the same as 10%, be the same as 5%. And then from a performance profile perspective, obviously it's interesting to me that, at least on my preliminary analysis, that the steeper the gradient, the stronger the correlation to overall performance. And I just think if you look at what UTCT is, which is obviously the race that I was modeling against, I mean, how many steep climbs are there on UTCT? I mean, you did the 20K or whatever, and you've got athletes who I'm sure have done the longer distances. There are just loads of like super steep sections. Yeah. And so how efficient you are within those components is really important. So what I learned between study 3 and 4 was that I need to constrain the athletes and not let them choose how they want to run those steeper gradients. Mm-hmm. So what I did was at the 10 kilometer an hour equivalent, 3.4 kilometers per hour, 25% gradient, I had them hiking. I said to them, you have to hike this time. I don't want any of this variability. You know, some people are hiking, then running, then hiking, blah, blah, blah. So I constrained that. And then at the 4 kilometer an hour equivalent, which is only 0.6 Ks an hour faster, I had them like in a running gait where you'll know how it feels to run uphill at like a steep gradient, a 1 to 4 gradient. You're like, you're kind of like on your toes, you know, with a bit of an arm, but it's not like you're flying up the hills kind of thing. And what I haven't yet looked at is whether the hiking or the running is kind of more strongly associated. I kind of group them at the moment, so there's a little bit of nuance to come in there still. Those are my main, I don't know, things that I've found interesting thus far and need to unpack further. You can hear that I enjoy talking about it, and I'm the same with my writing. So I write like very elaborate sentences and phrases, and then my supervisors are like, you need to cut out all of this like unnecessary stuff, and I'm like, I've only got like 3,000 words to put into this article. So that's a challenge.
That is tough. But Simon, I think the main thing is, like, people will be listening to this, and for those who love to like take the scientific things and like, you know, I want to implement this in my training. It's like for your average runner, it's like, what does this mean for me? You know, it's like, okay, so am I, like, efficiency is something you mentioned. It's like uphill running isn't always necessarily the key, which I think in an episode with Daniel Klaassen way back when, he like ran his first trail race on Table Mountain, and he came from a track background, and he was like, he didn't know that he had permission to walk. Like, he just never ever been allowed to, or like trained that way. So he like absolutely killed himself basically, like, on this trail race, because he was like, why do people not walk? And he got to the end, and everyone's like, bro, like, you should walk, you know, it's like strategic to have power hike. And but yeah, so like for your average runner listening to this and trying to like make sense of what this means for them, what would you say? Like, are these trainable things? No. Are we like, you know, you're either genetically gifted and you've got Eliud Kipchoge genes, or when it comes to uphill running, or there's no hope for you and it doesn't matter how much you train.
Well, two things before I get into this. So what? I think, first of all, don't never listen to somebody who says you'll never be good at something. You know, I was in a physiology lab setting like that once and did like kind of lung volume and some maximal testing. And the person just said, basically, based on what I can see, you'll never be a great athlete. And I was like, oh, that's still stuck with me to this day.
Wow.
And I don't think they meant it in like a learning teaching capacity. Like, let's compare Simon's profile to the norms. And like, Simon looks, you know, obviously like he's not an elite athlete.
Yeah, like my half marathon time's big to differ.
Well, you know, they're probably right. I'll never be a champion endurance athlete, but that's not, you know, that's neither here nor there. I think what we can all do is we can stand to work with what we've been given. And, you know, in a group of homogenous athletes who have very similar maximal capacities, it's the ones who can exercise at a higher proportion or relative percentage of their maximal capacity that will win the race. And I think that is very trainable. That's just through years and years of consistent effort. You can't get away from that. So that's the one thing. Don't listen to someone who says you'll never amount to something just in life in general. The other thing on Eliud Kipchoge, which I just can't believe the person is a human being. Like,
yeah.
And, you know, Calvin Kiptum and all of these great athletes as well. It's not to single out Kipchoge, but I was running some 1 minute repeats kind of on some of the farm roads here. And I did 8 repeats for 1 minute. And I was like, I was going full tilt, like, you know, feeling number one, feeling like I'm on top of the world. Like, look how fast I'm running. But number two, like really struggling to hold on, particularly towards the end of each repeat.
Yeah.
And then I went home and I was like, how fast was I running? I was like, I was running 3 minutes 20 per K, which, you know, sounds great and whatever. It's for 1 minute at 3:20. And Kipchoge's running 3 minutes a K for 42 kilometers for like 2 hours. How? I don't know if I can even run 3 minutes a K. Like, it is just on another planet in terms of performance. So that's a very much a side note, but I've just got tremendous respect for all of these elite athletes who we like to kind of glamorize and put them on a pedestal and be like, oh, you know, I wish I could be an elite athlete, or I'd like to do that. But I think the amount of you know, dedication to your craft to be that good at something, it's just unreal.
Yeah.
Okay, take home messages. thus far, I think take home message would be, if you're a trail runner, it's I don't want to say a waste of time, but almost a waste of time going to look at just your level running kind of performance as an idea of an indirect measure of how well you'll do in a trail race. So the old testing methodology of a 20-minute FTP, or going into a lab and doing a level maximal aerobic capacity test, or level running economy, I think it's shown over and over again to have, you know, a much more limited application, let's say, to the performance profile. It's not to say that it's not important at all, but I think if you're really taking your trail running seriously, you definitely need to include some uphill running testing, both from like a ceiling, like a limit perspective, and also from an efficiency perspective. And then the one thing that, unfortunately, through my PhD, that I haven't been able to tackle, mainly because of constraints with research and funding and time and treadmill logistics, is the downhill running condition, which we definitely know is important as well, particularly in the latter half of ultra races. You know, worse off athletes or worst performing athletes, let's say, tend to slow down to a greater degree than high performing athletes, because they're just not used to that demand, you know, that level of muscle pain and tear and breakdown. And it almost you know, completely derails their races. So I think you'd probably need to include some downhill running in there. And to what extent, what gradients, you know, I'm not quite sure, but I would say you want to include some steep uphill running in your testing batteries, but clearly also in your training. Like your training needs to look like your race. If your race has a lot of steep, you know, technical ascents, long ascents, make sure you try and replicate that in your training. Jan has been listening to a lot of David and Megan Roach. Obviously, I think David had some breakout performances in the 100-mile distance last year at Javelina, and I'm sure if it was Leadville or Hard Rock, I can't remember. They talk about kind of the downhill running protocols that they do to like expose athletes to just that level of pain, and the muscles to that level of eccentric loading.
Yeah.
And therefore muscle breakdown. And that's kind of really important to prepare runners for mountain races. So I would definitely include that in as well. But then also to get into the gym, you know, concentric, eccentric muscle loading, overload the muscles, let them do things that are beyond what they would typically get exposed to in a race. So tests in a specific manner, train in a specific manner. And then I think the one that's still kind of up for debate is like, how do we gauge our intensity? Like we know that we can't golf speed. Speed is out the window. Like speed is rubbish. Heart rate seems to have some application. You know, it's a little bit more sensitive to changes in gradient, but there are still some limitations because the oxygen demand at the level of the muscle might be higher. You know, we need to take that into account when we fuel, when we take on carbohydrates or whatever it is, and make sure that we're fueling appropriately for the metabolic demands. So eat lots of carbohydrate. There's a lot of research that's coming out now on like the Norwegians who are doing like, I don't know, 300 grams of carbohydrate, not quite an hour, but you know, 100, 150 grams. I haven't looked at that specifically, but I think make sure you fuel adequately. And I don't know, just a personal learning is just enjoy what you do. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, enjoy your running, enjoy your research or your job or whatever it is. Like, that's really important. And there's been times where it's been a struggle, but you've always got to go back to your why and try and find that enjoyment. And I've enjoyed going back to my undergraduate physiology kind of concepts, you know, and almost relearning those. That I'm not shy to say that I'm not, you know, I'm not a clinical physiologist. I'm not, that's not my thing that I do, and I know everything about all of the intricacies, but to go back into that and, you know, it was quite, it's been quite a fun process thus far.
That's awesome. Simon, I'm just so pumped that it's going well. I am excited to see final findings, like as you kind of dig a little bit more into the data analysis. And I know, like, I mean, Trail Science is a platform that you would like share findings in more like layman's terms or like for all these practicals and take homes, and I know that Rooted in Dirt would be as well. So as usual, I'm gonna plug that, put it in the show notes, and just like keep an eye on what Simon's doing. It's, I think, for anyone who was part of your research, it's exciting to know that there's like developments in this space and that it's relevant. I think that's just so great. And in like the spirit of things that are kind of what's relevant, what's next, I'm like, I want to park the PhD thing because I'm just keen to see like where it goes. Thank you for all the updates. And I think this year in the trail running space, like you mentioned some stuff that Jan has been listening to, but like, what are you excited about in particular? Like, what are we going to be chatting about? For example, I had a couple of people reach out. I mean, we mentioned the carb thing now. We should maybe grab Louise and get her to chat with us about some fueling things. But like, I had a few people DM me and they're like, when are you guys going to talk about super shoes and like carbon and like, and I was like, that's Great. That's cool, actually. Like, I would be keen. And it's like,
well, we can definitely do that. So again, more intel from this side. I'm literally in the midst of planning a Super Shoe project here at the University of Gloucestershire. So we've bought the shoes already.
Nice. Oh, you heard it here first, folks.
Yeah. So we've got some Alpha Flies and some just kind of Pegasus, like a control, you know, a comparison group. And we've got a plan to get a whole bunch of women runners through the lab. So in these like early studies on vapor flies and alpha flies, they found that running economy, which is not performance, it's just efficiency, it can be improved by up to 5% when you wear these kind of carbon plated shoes. And that then translates to maybe a 1 or 2% increase in performance over the course of a marathon or whatever. But a lot, as all of this research is, and we've talked about this on the show, it's done with men. You know, it's not explored through the female athlete lens. So we bought only women's shoes. I'm learning from my own mistakes, Emily. I've fallen into the trap before of you know, not giving women that platform. So we've got a study planned here. PhD student who's kind of on board to support and looking not only at the physiology, but also at the level of the muscle. So the kinetics and kinematics, like what happens to electrical activity and stimulation in the muscles, and also the muscle contraction. So looking at within the myofiber itself, what's the strength of contraction, the force of contraction.
Nice.
'Cause that has obviously the end impact on the oxygen cost. So we've got some studies planned. We could do a Super Shoe episode tomorrow, because I'm reading about this stuff as we go.
That's great.
That might be quite nice. And then, I don't know. It's the year of the carbohydrate. carbs are back in fashion, guys. Like,
they are.
I mean, there was a time when I was a student in Stellenbosch, if you said the word carbohydrate, you would have been booted out of the front door, you know.
Tim Noakes sort of.
Exactly. Tim would have driven up the end too from UCT and been like, you know, get out of here.
It's definitely making a comeback, Simon. And I think like there's a lot of questions around like fueling outside, like day-to-day fueling versus like in-race fueling, and like the role of the carbohydrate and like carb versus fat stores. And like there's actually only two schools of thought if you split it.
It's more. You either go like heavy ketosis, like heavy fat adapted, or you go huge on carbs.
400 carbs, send it down at the start of your session. And I think what people are wanting to know is like, is there a midpoint? Like, do I need to live in the extremes? If so, why?
Right.
And then like the layers on top of that are like, I feel like intermittent fasting is also making a comeback, you know? But now it's like you have people like me who are like, don't exercise fasted. Oh wow, you know me too well. But it's also like I'm like, don't go and do big sessions fasted, specifically as a woman, you know. And then people will like hear that and they're like, but wait, what? I'm hearing other things. And so I mean, those are some of the things I'm excited about and to unpack.
I think my general, not fear, but you know, we are in the age of misinformation and disinformation, and we all need to be careful about who we trust and what we read. The way that like social media platforms work nowadays is they get incentivized for engagement. So clicks and engagement is what earns you money. And so it's in everyone who uses that, it's in their best interest to put stuff that people are going to click on. It doesn't need to be true. There's no accountability. But if someone clicks on it, I'm happy, you know. And I think we all need to be skeptics and, you know, just be considering where we go for our information, our sources of information. There is research going into these things like carbohydrates, kind of fueling and gut training. I think, you know, those kinds of things are quite popular at the moment. I'm sure we'll see more research in that space because of people like the Norwegian group, and David Roach is a big proponent of that, and has obviously done really well. And so there's going to be more and more research that kind of follows in the wake of practice, good practice, let's say. I don't know, hybrid athletes, people entering trail running from, you know, spaces that are maybe not traditionally trail running spaces, yes, and pushing the needle a bit further. I think you've seen from the Golden Trail series, like, you know, really amazing runners coming from different areas and different backgrounds, and like Kenyan athletes, for example, East African athletes starting to come into, yeah, trail running. And then very shortly, you know, it's going to be much like the marathons, you know, East Africa dominating.
Takes over the world, yeah.
I don't know. I'm on the research side. I'm quite keen to kind of explore, I think I've mentioned this before, more of like the social dynamics element. I think like getting people outdoors and finding a place, like trail culture, right? Finding a space where you feel at home, that's positive. You know, we all are human beings and we want to belong to groups and identify, you know, within our kind of group structures that we build around ourselves, and
yeah,
what a healthy way to do it, you know, on mountains. So
yeah,
I'd like to do a little bit more research in that space. And I think there is some cool research on carbon footprint and environmental impact of things like trail running.
Yeah,
it's not really like performance related, but I think that's quite interesting to me.
Yeah,
especially with the with the conversations about Ironman and UTMB, this and that, and we live in that kind of world now, which demands travel and all of that. So it'd be good, yep, to shine an awareness on that, so we know what we're actually dealing with. Yeah, can't think of anything else at this moment, Em.
I, from a coaching perspective, I don't know if you know about this, but I want to chat. We don't have to do a whole episode on this, but we can find like ways to bring it in. I want to talk about Jason Koop's AI coaching model. Have you heard about this?
Does Jason Koop have an AI coaching model?
Yes,
I don't know. I mean,
he has taken himself and troubleshooted and developed a tool, like an AI coaching tool, and it's basically,
right,
like
off
asking
of like
Jason without
reasoning, right? Yeah,
yeah, his reasoning, but it's like all of his, like, it basically this program knows in theory how he would think and answer questions and make decisions.
Yeah. It's a scary old world that we live in, and I think I don't know. I feel like I'm an ostrich. Like, I just want to bury my head in the sand.
No.
Like, no, AI is like this existential threat. I don't know. I just feel nowadays you can get a training plan from anywhere. I mean, ChatGPT can write your training plan if you want to. But we lose that, I don't know, that authenticity, that, you know, working with someone and a coach. And I said to Jan, yeah, not long ago, I was like, I almost want to say, like, does Rooted in Dirt move towards an in-person only coaching style? Like, I don't know if I can coach people on the other side of the world and, you know, very rarely speak to them. And
yes,
you know,
this is a good topic, Simon. I've gone, like, I feel like I've lived on both sides of this extreme. So it would be a good one to
people let us know what they think about AI online coaching, and we can maybe debate some ideas there. But I think you know, as with anything, you can get a pretty good general structure, but then when it comes to problem shooting and the individual, and we know this in you know, even in like in physiology, for example, if you look at VO2 max tests, the number one marker for whether you've had a maximal test is whether you've reached a plateau in oxygen uptake,
yeah,
with increasing demand, because then you go into that anaerobic store, and the plateau is measured normally by less than a 150 milliliter change over the last minute oxygen uptake. But you get responders and non-responders, so you get people who don't really show a plateau, but they still reach a VO2 peak. And then you get people who do show a plateau. And it's like, we're not all the same. And I don't know. I just, that authenticity of it, I want to cling on to for as long as I can until AI has got me like propped up in my bed, feeding me Instagram, you know, live streams, and I'm having like carbohydrates injected into my stomach or whatever.
I'm excited. Okay, I'm going to add this to the list. But as we've said to our audience, to the people who listen to us, we want to talk about things that you want to listen to. So let us know. I'm going to put everything in the show notes. I think it's worth it to go beyond the paywall to read some of Simon's research. We are that excited about it. And Simon, I'm excited for the developments, the fact that you're going to get your PhD. It's going to be great. We'll be following and sharing. And thank you for sharing, like, just a bit of a progress update with us, if we can call it that. And good luck with the next couple of weeks of writing as you get stuck into kind of
making
it concise. And we'll be back next month for our next Trail Science episode, topic to be confirmed. We always appreciate chatting to you, Simon.
Thanks, Em. Thanks for your support, and it's lovely to catch up with you. We'll see you on the next one.
Awesome.